Hello and welcome to Resettled, the ECDC ACC podcast. I'm your producer and host, David Combs. This episode and this entire season of Resettled are brought to you by Anthem, Blue Cross, Blue Shield. We're tremendously grateful for their support. In this month's episode, I interviewed Daniel McKibib. He's originally from Ethiopia, and as you'll hear in this episode, Daniel was a leader of a democratic movement in his home country. As a result of his efforts to bring democracy to the nation, he narrowly escaped the country with his life. Many of his friends and colleagues were not so fortunate. We're honored to have him join us for this month's episode of Resettled. Let's get started. We're honored to have Daniel McKibib join us today. Daniel is the director of the City of Alexandria's Workforce Development Center. He holds more degrees than almost anyone I know. He has a BA in economics and a master's degree in human resources economics from Addis Ababa University. He holds an MBA with a finance specialty from Johns Hopkins University, as well as an MPA from Virginia Tech. And he's currently working on his PhD. Daniel, welcome to Resettled. And can you tell us how many PhDs you plan to acquire? just the one?
That's it.
Okay, all right, just one. Okay, Daniel has a truly remarkable story. And as you're going to hear throughout this podcast, his life is one of resilience and excellence. Daniel and I have worked together several years ago, and I have always loved my interactions with him. He's truly full of wisdom and depth. And Daniel, my friend, it's truly an honor to have you on the show.
Good to be with you, David.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, so you have such a remarkable story. Sometimes it's sort of difficult to know where to begin. So I think the simplest thing to do is just perhaps to begin the story at the beginning, as it turns out. So I wonder if you might tell our listeners about your youth growing up in Ethiopia.
Yeah, I think, you know, people have different pictures of Ethiopia depending on how they are exposed to that country. But yes, of course, some people might think of a drought and poverty situation. Some people, if they have in-depth knowledge, they would also appreciate the rich history of the country and the natural and the human resources of the country. So growing up in a country where there are economic challenges, but also possibilities, and most importantly, love and rich social and historical heritage, that always keeps you growing up proud of who you are and the country you have, including the fact that Ethiopia is one of the only two countries that has never been colonized in Africa. So that also gives you a sense of pride and citizenship. So there are so many great memories, from childhood in Ethiopia.
I find that when I have these kinds of interviews with folks, one thing I love to ask is just if people have some either memory or something that they just particularly loved from their time growing up that people may not know about or think about. I wonder if there's just something from your childhood that if you could say, hey, there's this wonderful memory, there's this wonderful thing that a person who's never been there, has never experienced it, they should know that these are the kinds of wonderful things that I experienced growing up. Do you have anything like that?
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Addis Ababa, so I'm not as much exposed to the rural areas except what I hear from my relatives who come from the rural areas to visit us. So my first exposure to going out to see the rural areas was when I was in second year student, actually a freshman student in university. There was a transition and we had to go to the war. There was a war going on, so most university students were taken to a military camp to get trained during the Civil War. So that was my first ever experience to go outside of Addis, and there was, it was difficult, it was hard, but full of exposures as a university student. There was about, at least in the camp I was in, there was at least 6,000 students training. Fascinating experience. So that's one that comes to mind.
Well, what kinds of fascinating experience, if you can, what kind of fascinating experiences did you have? That sounds like that must have been a formative time for you.
It was, in particular, this incident. You know, growing up in Addis, I've always lived with my parents and never had to leave home. And the minute you leave, it would be, you know, far away in a remote area, getting trained in an army base, and then you miss your parents. So it was a very interesting and challenging experience. And I remember one day, you know, where we had to leave the camp for adventure with a group of friends where we were hungry, and on our way back to the bank, we had to hunt and eat an animal on the way. And that was, you know, quite an experience, which for an urban-raised young man, it was quite an extraordinary experience. So these were formative times, I mean, in terms of being exposed to social and, of course, meeting people from very different walks of life than the kind of experience I had growing up. So that always comes to mind as something extraordinary.
That makes sense. Now, one thing you mentioned there was that, if I heard you properly, you were in school at University of Addis Ababa, and you were pulled away to do this training. What were you feeling when you got pulled away to do training? Did you feel like, oh no, my schooling is going to be on the back burner? Did you worry that you might not be able to get back to it?
Exactly. You know, that was one of the toughest moments in the country. And there was civil war. And so the rebels were coming close to, you know, the capital. And the then president of the country, we as students, you know, brave idealist groups of students at the main campus, we wanted to challenge the president. What are you doing? There are economic challenges. And that was a time that the Soviet Union was collapsing and the impact of communism collapsing was also being felt in the country, since Ethiopia was one of those allied countries with the US, former Soviet Union. So there was a lot of political, economic changes happening. So as a group of university students, we gathered thousands of us on the university campus, and there was a call to challenge the president, and a few of the students were selected to go and challenge the then president Mengistu, who now is still alive and resides in Zimbabwe. So to our surprise, I think that letter was sent to him in the afternoon, and late in the evening, we got news that the president was willing to come to the university campus and hear what we had to say and discuss with us. So the following day, full of the main auditorium, students gathered, and the president came in, and the initial idea was to challenge the president about his policies and the need for transition in the country. But somehow some would say manipulated, you know, our youthhood. And somehow the end result was, all the discussions can come later. Are you here? Are you willing to go and stand for your country? So somehow, you know, there was a mob and, you know, all things that you can imagine when thousands of youths gather in such an environment. So there was an impromptu decision where students volunteered to go to the military camps and fight. So it was interesting, and he did not hesitate. The following day, he sent all his folks to start registering students. So there was a challenge on students' mind. So there was a feeling that students who do not volunteer to go to the military camps were not going to be accepted back on university campuses. And so some people actually decided to go so as not to lose the opportunity to come back and continue their education, while some were actually convinced with the mission. So it was a very tough moment. And finally, you know, I think probably 3-4 days after, there were buses, you know, to take students off to military camps. So things had, you know, a very sudden shift from the time that we casually brought those issues and, you know, challenged the president, and a few days after going to the military camps.
How long were you in the military camp, and how long were you in training?
So they trained us for about 3 months in the military camps, and things again continue to have changed and a speed of light, because I remember a day when we were told that the president was going to fly to the military camp to motivate and encourage people. And some students do notice that his airplane was flying down on the military camp, but that military camp was close to Kenya, Nairobi. So apparently what happened later on was he was actually coming, but then, I mean, you know, depending on who you speak, you hear different stories. But the truth is, he actually flew that afternoon. He fled to Nairobi and from Nairobi to Zimbabwe. That was it. So at that moment, we had to decide for ourselves because the country was without a president. He temporarily assigned his designee, but that was not helpful at all. At that moment, Eritrea immediately got its temporary independence, and then the rebels were taking over most of the country. So many of the students had to decide where to go from where from there. You know, I was one of the, you know, I and many students were one of the last groups to leave the campus. Thousands of students, you know, fled to Kenya to become refugees. And then some of us, we had to save ourselves. I remember eight of us started leaving the camp and we had to walk a very, very long walk, hundreds of kilometers, as we use in Ethiopia, we don't use miles, you know, to find a safe place. And in particular, the first day, I think it was around 2 a.m. I mean, at 9 a.m., we got on the news, the Voice of America announced that the country was now in you know, most of the country was in the hands of the rebels, and things are changing. And then we slept. It was around 3 a.m. at night in a very deserted place in a bush. Many of us sleeping, some of us, because there were some animals, lions, and so forth and so forth. So some students were taking turns to protect us. You know, we were armed to protect ourselves from wild animals. And then at 3 a.m., we heard a big truck coming down. This guy, I think he jumped into... far away from there, he was. He saw this big truck where they transport animals. He saw that and he felt the need that he has to drive back hundreds of kilometers to save us, because they knew that there was some of us behind far away in that remote area. So we woke up and then we got into that truck. It was very comfortable for people who had a near-death experience, even if that car was not by any stretch a good place to be. But given the circumstance, that was the best thing that could have happened to us. So we, in the morning, the following day, interestingly, that was my birthday, May 28th. That was the same day that the new leaders, the rebel leaders, took over the country. And that was the day that we made it to the nearby city where the Red Cross took us over, and they gave us tents and we were sleeping on roadside in tents. That was the way we stayed for about 7 days after that. It was quite an extraordinary experience.
I truly can't imagine. I'm wondering if you can remember some of the thoughts and feelings that were going through your mind at this time. I mean, like that level of instability, I mean, it must have caused just such great mental challenge. Can you recall some of the things you were thinking and feeling at that time?
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, even around the time that we were leaving the camp, some adventurous students who were just playing with armaments, because the camp was full of heavy weaponry and there was no one in charge of the camp because many officers had fled to save their own life and there was no rule of law, there was no order. It was just a crazy place. And some students were, you know, drunk sometimes. You see all kinds of crazy stuff going on. So just to find yourself in that situation, you don't have a sense of tomorrow. You don't know what to expect. And then for, as I mentioned to you, I only, traveled probably a couple of miles or so in an urban setting. Otherwise, you know, I'm not the type of strong, you know, young man who grew up in rural areas who used to, you know, walking 10 miles or, you know, 15, 20 miles. So for that person and many of us in my group, actually, you know, seeing hundreds of miles of walk in front of you, it's, you know, some of us prayed, you know what, We don't want to be exposed to an animal or, you know, die out of hunger or, you know, disease here. You know, sometimes you wish, you know, the easier way to die. So it was a very traumatic and, you know, it was very difficult to imagine what tomorrow was going to look like. And also we hear some horrific stories from some of the students that traveled ahead of us. Some got bitten and eaten by wild animals and some other, you know, crazy incidents. So it was a very difficult experience.
Now, you just said that one of the challenges was just not having a sense of tomorrow and not having a sense of what was to come. How long did it take from this time until, I mean, like one of the things I mentioned when we let off the show was that you have more degrees than almost anyone I know, probably more than anyone I know. So at some point, tomorrow arrived, and at some point, things began to stabilize. How long was it from that moment? And in fact, maybe could you set the context for the listeners of what year that was, up until the time when you felt like, hey, there is a tomorrow, and now I'm returning to be a student again, and life has some form of a normalcy?
Yeah, I believe that was 92, 93. So Ethiopians have, you know, our calendar. So sometimes we confuse the European calendar with the Ethiopian calendar. So I hope I'm not confusing it. It was 92 at that time. And it was a week after that, you know, making it to that peaceful city that I safely moved back and connected with family in Addis Ababa. So it was a very celebratory moment for all of us because we were not sure if we were ever to be connected again. So universities were suspended for quite a long period of time. And then after almost a year, we went back to the university and life continued, of course. I mean, that transition, government transition, was a very bumpy one because students continued to oppose and there were all kinds of things happening. And during my four-year university, I think there was a couple of times that university educations were suspended for months due to unrest and conflicts. But eventually, it was in 1994 that I graduated with my bachelor in economics. So that was, you know, how life went back to some sort of normalcy.
So, and at that point, did you decide to go and get your master's degree right afterwards, or did you work for a little while before you went back for some additional education?
No, I actually worked for about 4 years. After that, for a couple of organizations, and including a development bank where I was supporting. And that was another opportunity where I had to go to a rural place where we were serving as loan officers for small rural agricultural and economic projects, private projects. So we used to go and prove, for example, coffee farms as they build their small coffee farm or some other industrial and hotel projects. So these were very instrumental in terms of helping community development. So that was a very interesting project. So I did some of that before I went back to school to do my master's. And luckily, while I was doing my master's, I was also supported by the Ministry of, I joined the government and I was working for the Ministry of Economic Development and Cooperation. Very interesting work while at the same time attending my graduate studies.
Now, throughout this time, did you have a sense that, and we're going to talk about this in a few minutes, and if your story wasn't interesting enough already, it's about to get even more complex. During that time when you're at the university and you're doing this work for the government, were you finding that you had challenges with the new government that was in place?
Yeah, of course, you know, you always have an interesting dynamic. Some of the government institutions are truly professional, especially at the lower ranks, other than the ministerial levels. And the ministry that I was working was one of the most the most respected institutions in terms of professionalism. In fact, it used to be known as the intellectual arm of the government, and only the top students used to be recruited and used to join that arm, that ministry, because that is a ministry that used to plan, you know, Ethiopia used to be a communist country, socialist country, and then everything was centrally planned. So that was the ministry that planned the development of the country. So you can imagine the intellectual power that has to go into that planning process. I mean, by the time I joined, it wasn't doing that kind of central planning, but it was very instrumental in many areas. For example, the work that I was doing included, because that was a transition period and the new government had a very aggressive economic development work. They had, you know, ambitious development projects, for example, hundreds of schools, if not thousands of schools or health centers, and huge road infrastructure projects were to be submitted for international financing, World Bank, the African Development Bank, the European Union, many international multilateral financing organizations. So I and my team used to do the evaluation of those proposals before they were submitted for such financing, because you're talking about hundreds of millions and billions of spending. So we have to make sure they were feasible in terms of environmentally, financially, economically, and socially, and they were worth the kind of priority they were seeking. So we had to turn them down. We had to ask for modifications before they are approved for international financing. So it was a very crucial work. And then after they were financed, we also had to do monitoring and evaluation to ensure that they are on track, they are successful, and if there was some tweaking needed, we had to serve as an intermediary between the donors and also the implementing state governments to ensure that they are benefiting the public. So in that case, most of what we did was professional, so it wasn't necessarily impacted by political interference from the new government. So I was proud of the work we've done while I worked for that ministry.
That sounds like truly exciting and kind of remarkable work in a lot of ways. I mean, you must have had, for a newly graduated economics student, that must have just been again, I hate to use the word formative again, but it must have been a time of great development for you.
It was. And, you know, you feel a sense of pride, a sense of service, and because you know the value of what you're working on. But interestingly, many of those things I was doing in the 2+ years I was, doing my master's. And right after I finished, I had the opportunity to join a different organization. That was the Ethiopian Economic Association, and they had a research institute. So I joined their policy research. So from being government bureaucrat implementing projects, now I shifted to policy research and evaluating how effective our policies are, how transformative they were. You know, this was an independent, it was not a government agency, it was a civic organization, but it was probably the number one independently known and probably the most effective civic organization in the country at that moment. So I was part of that work, and my work mainly focused on economic research, policy research in the areas of poverty, human resource economics, and health education, that sort of topics. I was proud of the work that we did, and it was very professionally rewarding work. But now with the research, then that gave me another layer of experience.
I mean, that's really fascinating. Now, at some point, where at this point you're talking about how you're doing a lot of policy research and you're doing a lot of sort of nuts and bolts government work. At some point, you begin to transition yourself to some amount of political work. What caused that change, and what caused that desire for you to take that up?
That's a very good question. So as you can imagine, working in government in those, huge investments to improve living conditions in the country, and then focusing on research and how where some of the issues are, where the opportunities are. And to add to that, at the same time, I was also an adjunct professor at the university. I was teaching economics, and so one of the courses that I was teaching focused on the Ethiopian economy. And typically, you focus on what the resource potentials of the country was. You discuss chapter by chapter the various natural resources the country is endowed with. And then you also talk about the underperformance of the economy and the challenges, the human conditions. Then students always ask you, as if you don't ask that question yourself, well, if we have all these resources, why are we suffering with this level of abject poverty? People ask us those questions, and you ask those questions. And even in my day job at the research institute, these are the kind of things that we deal with. One of the things that would explain such a paradox is leadership. You got to have you know, an effective and a responsive leadership that you can hold to account. Unfortunately, the country has never had a democratically elected government, you know, until 1974. It was a monarchy, and then after that, it was a communist regime. And now the regime at that moment was a group that came to power by, you know, by the power of the gun. So I think the people do not have the option to hold their leaders accountable and to make them responsive to their needs. So leadership was key. Democracy was something that probably needs to happen in the country. So while all these things were going on in my mind, and I bet in many people's minds, what happened was Ethiopia was going to have one of the freest ever election that was made in 2005. And by that time, I spent about 4 or 5 years at that research institute. And some of the leaders of that research institute and other academics and some very well-renowned individuals were, you know, pondering the possibility of running for office in that election. So I committed myself to support them in any way I can, even if I was not envisioning running for office myself. So that's where things started shaping up in an interesting way. So they thought, that group thought, forming a political party. I mean, I think one of the issues in the country was the opposition was weak. It was weak mainly because, I mean, I guess the ruling party was very active in weakening the opposition, but the opposition also was doing the homework for the ruling party by not being as organized and as unified, because they were dividing the votes and there were many issues. So because of the popularities of those individuals, they decided to form a party, and it was about 5-6 of us that formed that party. So I was a founding member of that party. So I kept organizing intellectuals and youth and individuals, young people in particular, who have the vision to transform the country and also who can bring a fresh perspective to the political landscape. So that party became one of the four-part coalition that stood. So we're not going to divide the vote. We're going to go into this election as a coalition. And it used to be called Coalition for Unity and Democracy. So that was probably one of the most impactful work that we've done. And so that election was conducted in May 2005. And unfortunately, things did not continue as we were hoping because of some actions taken by the ruling party.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because, I mean, I would imagine there's a number of things going on here. One, I would imagine that when this all began, you must have had a certain amount of rush of excitement of a potentially free and fair election. And then the organization that you were putting together with your colleagues and trying to set some path for positive change. And then this goes sideways and the ruling party engages in some kind of misbehavior. I wonder if you can talk about a little bit about some of the things you were feeling and thinking at the time, and then the kinds of activities that the ruling party began to engage in that made you come to realize this is not going right.
No, exactly. I think leading up to, I think when the election preparation started, I remember, you know, the election was supposed to be in May. And as I was organizing some youth groups as early as, you know, August and September, some people were laughing at us. They did not take as seriously because forming a party that late into the game, and, you know, they were not really convinced. But we were convinced that this time it was going to be a different one. But saying as, you know, some of the activities in terms of the opposition coming together in one front, and also some of the debates started, you know, free airtime and free debates. It was very unprecedented. There was a breeze of fresh air in the country, and people started to smell and taste democracy. It was a special moment. I cannot express it. I cannot find a word that would express the kind of feeling that was all over in the country. It was so beautiful. We really loved, you know, the smell of democracy in that country. But it was so unfortunate. I think it looks like the ruling party only allowed democracy to the extent it doesn't threaten their seat. And so the election happened May 7, 2005. And then, you know, in urban areas, you would get election results in real time. But in rural areas, it takes a while. So the first election results started to come out of the urban areas, including the capital. The regional seat for in the capital city, it had 138 seats. And out of that one, those 138 seats, the opposition that I was part of won 137. Imagine it is four parties coming together. At least two of the parties were, you know, the oldest, and they have a very wide base, and they have been in the business for some time. And but instead of dividing the votes, they come together. So all those strategies and the kind of excitement that was happening throughout the election, it started paying, you know, dividend. You know, it was just unbelievable. And but then, while that created some positive excitement in the opposition side, it wasn't felt the same way on the ruling party side. So they started banning demonstrations, and also they literally stopped the counting of votes in many places, and all those nasty things started happening, and people were angry in a few weeks, and there was all kinds of, you know, taking to the streets and, demonstrations. And there were at least a couple of them, especially in June, where so many people got killed on the street, and then the opposition got arrested. Many of the people who ran for office, including those friends of mine with whom we formed the party that I was referencing to, were put to jail. And I was just waiting for my turn by the time, you know, November came, and I had a prearranged, you know, leadership seminar in Singapore. So I was kind of hesitant, but it came and I had to leave in Singapore. It was in Singapore that I discovered my turn has arrived.
So when you're sitting in Singapore, you get some information. Well, I don't know if you're in your hotel room or where you were, but can you talk a little bit about what that experience was? Because you're sitting in Singapore and all of a sudden some information comes to you that I truly can't imagine. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It was a powerful experience. And, even if I had suspected at some point something would come, but it never is the same as when you're actually confronted with, the reality. So I was in my hotel room in Singapore. It was a three-week training program, and I only had probably a few hundred dollars, and also a small bag of clothes, you know, that was just sufficient for about 3 weeks stay. So it was 5 days into my training that I got an email from my wife. I was only married about a year and probably less than 2 years, and my son was just I don't think he was one, but it was a very interesting moment. So she sends me an email and I read it. So in the morning of that Friday, seven soldiers were in my wife looking for me, and they were searching throughout the house and threatening my wife, you know, if we find him somewhere. No, he already left the country five days ago. He's not here. If you are cheating, then we will come after you and your child, that they were threatening them. I don't know why seven soldiers would have to come just for one for me. At any rate, it was a very horrific experience for my wife and for my young son. So they finally, as a matter of fact, they forced her to call my number from her number, hoping that I will pick it up seeing her number. So I guess they tried everything, and then they knew I was outside, so they couldn't do much. But at that moment, it was a very difficult decision moment for me. I had two options. One was to go back directly to Ethiopia, and I know the threat is I'll be picked up from the airport and I will join my friends. Would that add to them or to the cause? Not much, a little. And then, you know, moving on from there, I feel like I'm betraying my colleagues. But at the same time, that may also give me the opportunity to continue wherever I am. So it was a very tough decision. I had to really, really think about what a good decision was going to look like. And even on a personal level, I did not feel safe enough because, as you may know, Singapore was not a signatory of the Refugee Convention. So this is not the kind of thing that they want to hear. They are close to a communist country, it's China. So if they were to entertain this, the kind of rights that refugee management would require, there will be an influx. So That's not the country that I would feel safe enough to stay as a political refugee. So there were all kinds of things coming to my mind.
When you received the email from your wife, can you talk for a minute about what the, you must have initially had some rush of feeling. I don't know what that would have been, fear or anger or probably some mixture of them all. And it probably then would take a little bit of time before you can even think straight, I would think. Is, can you describe that in a way that for folks to understand? Because no one can put themselves in your shoes. So can you help us understand that a little bit more?
Exactly. I mean, it was a very tough moment to be in. I mean, there weren't many people from Ethiopia. I mean, this was a group, probably about 40, 50 people from different parts of the country. There were a couple from Ethiopia, but I was in my room by myself, just reading and making sense of that and the implication of that information. I mean, it has a very, very long ranging implication from now to tomorrow and next year, especially as someone who has a young family. What does that mean to them? What does that mean to me? And what does literally tomorrow is going to look like? So part of me was very angry and confused and to some degree traumatized, but also there is also a sense that, look, yes, I am in this situation, but many more people lost their lives weeks and days and months before that as a result of this election. What would the family members think about what they had to go through? And many of these colleagues of mine who are in jail, you know, some of them were being tortured, you know, in prison. So I think you have to put things in perspective. I think that sometimes helps you to manage what you're going through. So I guess I was perplexed, angry, confused, and sad. But at the same time, when I put things in perspective, I get the encouragement and also the perseverance that comes from knowing this is a price that you would pay for a good cause, because democracy is not never cheap. Freedom is never cheap. People over the years have paid, you know, a huge price to make something as precious as freedom and the respect of human rights and democracy to make it a reality. So I think considering, understanding, and coming back to your senses to make sense of the, you know, the situation with the benefit of the greater context, why we are here in the first place, I think that helps you. Otherwise, it was a very difficult moment.
I truly can't imagine. When you were experiencing that, how much fear did you have for your wife and for your son? Were you concerned that they'd be taken away, or did you feel like the regime would essentially leave them alone, or did you just not know?
No, as a matter of fact, you know, even when I was there, you know, they have plenty of people that they would assign to follow you everywhere you go. So I was kind of so used to, you know, people following me everywhere I go. Sometimes they take your picture on a mobile phone and probably they will report it. So they had all sorts of intimidation tactics, and just don't ask me how much they would afford to assign people to every little opposition member that they see. So in a sense, both myself and my wife were used to it. I remember one day, you know, they were chasing me as I was going to a church, and I was stranded for a few hours in one of those tense moments, partly because I was giving a ride to some of the opposition leaders in my car. I mean, we've seen some of the most difficult situations, and my wife was in the car in one of those days that I was stranded. I was literally under custody by a group of security forces. And so she has a glimpse of that. So she was stronger than I thought she would be. But after I left, you know, even while I was in Singapore and even after I moved to the US, there were times that she was being followed and, you know, some stressful, because sometimes you feel like, okay, if you need me, go take me. But why are you following me? Sometimes you choose to be taken into custody than somebody always following you. It just has some weird feeling when you're being followed every day and everywhere you go.
Now, you claimed asylum in Singapore, but you ended up in the U.S. in Washington, D.C. not long after. Can you talk a little bit about how, once you sort of gathered yourself after you get this initial information and you started to go through the process, how did you manage to get yourself sort of taken care of at least enough that you could stay in Singapore and then get on to the U.S.?
I would consider my life, every time I reflect on things that I had to go through, I consider myself a very lucky person. I think I was fortunate. I think this was one of those instances because I was reading recently that the average life of a refugee, globally speaking, it ranges anywhere between 15 to 20 years before they had a durable solution. Durable solution meaning, you know, going back to a safe country they came from, or, you know, having a resettlement option or integration where they are temporarily staying. I can't imagine, you know, 15, 18, 20 years in that type of limbo, you know, before you have some kind of durable permanent solution. My situation didn't last that long. I think that's why I consider myself fortunate. I did visit the U.S. Embassy in Singapore to explain my situation, and some of the contacts I had both inside the jail or at that moment that I continued to communicating directly, and some of our supporters in other places. I got, you know, I was fortunate, as I mentioned. So there is one of the largest refugee programs of the U.S. government in that part of the world. It was in Thailand, Bangkok. So I had three people actually to come and meet with me in Singapore just to, as part of my case, including, you know, the Homeland Security folks who would come and interview you and adjudicate on your refugee or asylum protection request. And also the International Rescue Committee representatives who would facilitate and support through that process. And also the IOM, International Organization for Migration, who would facilitate the travel, the air ticket that you would have to come back. So all that happened, you know, by those folks traveling to Singapore to do those things. I am very grateful for this program and all this, the system, as well as the individuals working for this system, because the kind of care and support and understanding and professionalism they were handling their work was just, it always stayed with me and will do in the future too. So I think everything got processed in about 2 months or so. So this happened probably 2 months, and I had a waiting period between the time I got approved and the time I flew to the U.S. So by February, I believe it was February 6th that I arrived in the U.S. as a refugee.
So that's February, you said 2006. So yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And then so when you arrive in the U.S., it's probably got to be rather cold if it's February 2006. And was that your first time to the U.S. at that point?
So it was not. 2 years ago, I won a fellowship. Some of the policy work and the research work I did, I published a report on the economic impacts of family planning in Ethiopia. So mainly population pressure and its economic impact on labor force, agricultural productivity. So we did some projections on the fertility rates, if it was to increase, what it will come. So there was a study that I conducted, and also I trained some of the regional parliaments in different parts of the country to educate them on the economic impact of health and family planning and education in the country. So that got me into a leadership fellowship program in Berkeley, California. So I stayed at a program. Part of it was at the University of California, Berkeley, and some other places. So, and also partly supported by the David and Lucille Packard Foundation. So I came to California in 2004. As a result of that, I stayed here about 2-3 months. So that was it. But that was A, it was in the summer. B, it was in sunny California. So you're right, February was cold. That was the first time I had a sense of cold, or, you know, the cold weather looked like. So I got picked at the airport by a refugee case manager from Lutheran Social Services, probably around 1 a.m. at Dulles Airport. And they picked me from the airport, and they had already arranged a room for me to stay with three other Ethiopian men. So they dropped me in that house. So it was quite an experience. It was new. I did not know what to expect. But again, I'm very grateful for that experience.
So what were the first things that you were trying to do once you got yourself settled? I imagine that took a little bit of time, but you probably had a number of things on your mind. You probably needed to find work. You needed to try and find a way to bring your family to the U.S. What were the things that you were trying to accomplish once you got your mind around your new situation?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, from the resettlement agency side, they will have to take you to, you know, they have to drive you to a place where, you know, to get your social security, ID, and all that good stuff. So they keep you busy, you know, doing all those things. And then, you know, at a personal level, making a connection with my family and, you know, their well-being and the possibility of them joining me together here. And also the toughest one, which I thought it was an easy one, but it took years. That is, who am I in the U.S.? I know what I did professionally in my country. I knew why I was. I know how my education and training was aligned in what I was doing. But now, do those things matter here? Who am I? I think reconfiguring oneself, rebranding oneself. I mean, before you can make it known to other people, here is I, who I am. This is what I can do. You have to convince yourself, who are you? What is your career? What's your profession? Because the kind of work that I did was not necessarily relevant here. I mean, I was an economic researcher. I was working for the government agency I was telling you about. Those agencies are not here. But that, does that mean your skills are not relevant, or there was not, you know, any way that you can transfer some of skills and work for others? It was a tough one. That transition, many skilled professionals struggle with that. For some, it takes years before they find an answer. And you have to have somebody to help you navigate that. So that was more of at the professional level, a question that I had to struggle with. But on a family basis also, you know, thinking of the opportunity where I can reconnect with my family and rebuild my life. And of course, the bigger one was, okay, I came here because of a cause and I cannot abandon that cause. So what am I going to do to help support the release of those colleagues that were jailed? So I joined the international chapter of the opposition group that was here. And I was part of the leadership of that group. And we did, I mean, it was quite a difficult thing to do. It has its own complexities, but we managed to organize and strengthen the diaspora-based support base for cause, not just in the U.S., in Europe, Australia, and Africa, and many parts of the world. And we eventually formed a strong and bigger organization. And I also had a very continuous relationship with folks at the State Department and Friends of Ethiopia in Congress and in the Senate. We worked on a regular basis with them to push for legislations that supported the release of the opposition leaders, which finally became successful. So they got released from jail 18 months after that. So a number of things came to my mind. And I think, as I mentioned, some of them came to fruition a few months of arriving in the U.S.
Did you find that was, I mean, that must have been provided a strong sense of community and a strong sense of, again, like you said, that purpose that you were sort of searching for. Did you find that provided you more of that sense of purpose, or ultimately, because you end up, you know, and we haven't even talked yet about, you know, the professional, because you did reinvent yourself and you did find ways to find this sort of professional career. Did you find that was sort of like the first element of you reinventing yourself was getting back with the community and trying to still continue some work back in Ethiopia?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the good thing, I mean, just to give you a sense of that, even if they gave me that house with, you know, three other Ethiopian men, four of us to live in that house, probably I did not stay in that house for too long. I spent most of my week in Maryland because, some of the leaders who worked with me to create that community, you know, the support community for the political cause were in DC and Maryland. So I had to spend, days and nights working hard there and making a very strong connection with what's going on in Ethiopia. We had successfully conducted so many operations in terms of advocacy, in terms of securing some resolutions and legislatives. The government was hiring lobbyists, but we did not have lobbyists. We were doing the work by ourselves. So I think in the course of doing that, there was a very strong sense of community, having a very clear goal of what needed to be done, not only to get to secure the release of those leaders, but also, we're talking about hundreds of people who are in jail. And by some estimates, there were also others, thousands in different parts of the country. But at least the ones who ran for office and got jailed were, several, key figures. So I think all that was happening as we collaborated and worked on as a community. So that continued. But yeah, you're right. On a personal level, I think I would say, it was about, at least for the first 6 months, I decided, to focus on the cause because quite a lot of work. But then I sensed, okay, yes, I have to do this. But the only way I can sustain my work is if I have to stand on my feet and I have to support myself. So I had to balance. I had to balance that. And as part of that work, and especially as you come as a refugee, the Refugee Resettlement Agency is required to secure that you have a job within certain months of arrival. So I had to also make sure that I meet that goal. So one day when they were discussing my plan, I told my case manager, saying, "Hey, what's the plan?" I said, "Why can't I volunteer for you?" And they never had this kind of request. "Yeah, I can do some of the good work that you're doing, so I can help you with case management." And then she spoke to her boss, and they allowed me to volunteer 3 days a week. So that's how I started, my professional work on a volunteer capacity, because that would give me an entry point into the professions. Some of my connections at the World Bank, they gave me a visit. I visited them in the office. They were trying to give me some freelance work, which I did here and there, but that was not necessarily a permanent thing, because most of those kind of jobs, it would be easier if you were abroad. So that didn't go too long. But it was in one of those occasions that my case manager was invited to speak on NPR as a part of a panel in connection with an event that was conducted at John Hopkins Bethesda campus by a very visionary woman. She was a professor, law professor at Montgomery College. She saw what I was telling you, the challenges faced by immigrant professionals in the US. So she put together a professional day event for anyone with foreign earned degrees and experience from abroad. So I attended that event. And one of the people that I found there, I gave them my resume. She came from Fairfax County as part of, so one was a professional conversation discussion, but the second part of it was some sort of a job fair. So at that part of the event, I gave my resume. And a few days later, I got invited for an interview. So that's how I ended up working for Fairfax County. That was my first job. That was September 2006. So probably I worked there for about 4 months, and I was offered an interview for a permanent position because I did not have health insurance. That was more of an exempt position. But in 4 months, they saw the value I brought to the work, and they offered me an interviewing for a permanent position, a promotional opportunity. Interestingly, the interview was scheduled on the day that my wife and my son were arriving at the airport. So I did not want to send somebody else to pick them at the airport. It was so meaningful, so important to me. So I had to ask my employer, "I don't want to give up this opportunity. Please don't get me wrong. Could you please reschedule this for me?" And they said, "Absolutely." They scheduled. And unfortunately, IOM rescheduled the flight again, and it happened on the same day. And I did not know how to, because I know what that health insurance was going to mean for me if I got the position, especially when my family was coming. Long story short, Fairfax County managers, they were so kind and so supportive. So they adjusted it, and I had the opportunity to welcome my family. And long story short, I got that position. So I and my family was covered with health insurance, and I got some bump in salary. So, yeah.
Can you talk just for a minute about what it meant to you to have your family get off the plane and see? Because it had been right about a year, I think. Is that correct?
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about what that felt like to see them again?
So, you know, as they were coming, you know, off the airport from the luggage area, my son, it was a very interesting thing. You know, at that moment, I think he was almost 2. He saw me. He laughed and he rolled on the floor, and he didn't know what to do. I can see so many emotions getting mixed up in his mind. And frankly speaking, I was not showing it the way he was showing it, but that experience was not his alone. And also my wife, you know, as a young family, as a newlywed, it was a tough thing, you know, to be separated this way. So I was so glad to see them and to hug them and, to imagine a new life together as a family. It was a special moment.
It must have been. And to have all of these things happening where you're coming up with a new job and getting yourself on your feet and your family arriving, it must have just felt like the world had changed so fundamentally for you in hopefully a lovely way.
Absolutely. You know, I'm very grateful, as I told you, you know, when I reflect on this, I mean, I am, you know, it gives me some perspective, and all you could do is just pay it forward. I think as you see some of these things, just have to make yourself, I mean, every step of the way for these things to happen, it took one person here, one person there doing their job. I'm very grateful. I think my life has always been surrounded by so many kind, generous and good people. I consider myself fortunate. So it was a very good reunion.
So now at some point in 2016, you come to the City of Alexandria's Workforce Development Center, and that's where you and I crossed paths for the first time. What drove that move away from the city, from Fairfax, to the City of Alexandria, to this current position you're in?
Yeah, it's interesting. So probably, you know, before that, you know, that question of who am I professionally, who am I? Yes, I'm glad. To be honest with you, when I took that Fairfax County job, I never thought I would stay more than, you know, a few months and a year, maybe max, because that was not necessarily what I thought my career was and was going to be. But, you know, I thought if I did MBA and did, you know, some finance and investment concentration, if I went to Wall Street, that would be the way to do it. So I decided to study investment finance at Johns Hopkins. And I did get, but unfortunately, that was around 2008. That was a time the market crashed.
Right, right.
Wall Street was bleeding 150,000 jobs a day. I remember reading a Yahoo News article where a Wall Street banker used to eat at a restaurant, and he was spending quite a lot of money, you know, every time he eats, because that was a pricey restaurant. But as a result of the recession, he applied for a job working, serving at that restaurant. That was how difficult that moment was. And many Wall Street traders who never went to school, but were doing those the work simply out of experience, decided to go back to school. And some of my classmates were actually Wall Street traders. So it was an interesting moment. So after graduation, going back to Wall Street would be me just showing my probably a CFA certification and an MBA and corporate finance certificate to compete with folks who have done years of work experience. So I knew that was not going to cut it. So I had to rearrange. And when I applied for positions within Fairfax using my MBA, you know, the government sector was more interested in MPA than MBA. So there was luckily a local government management certificate program, which almost fully financed, you know, without me paying for it, through scholarships and tuition assistance from my employer. So I said, okay, let me do that. So I did 4 courses of certificate, and then it gives you automatic admission to the MPA program. And I was also able to transfer some of my courses from the MBA program. So all in all, that's how I did, because I thought that that was when I got a sense of public service was my place in the U.S. That's where I finally figured who I was professionally in the US, and I had to build on my MPA and government work. So, and in the course of doing that, I got promoted as a result of partly my education, and I worked for about 10 years in Fairfax County. And by the time I left Fairfax, I was managing different initiatives. I'm a kind of person who enjoy creating things and improving performance, serving people. So I think I did quite a lot of that in my the opportunity I got in Fairfax. So I was really interested in a new set of challenge, because having done much of what I wanted to do in Fairfax. So when the Alexandria opportunity came, I jumped on it and I went to Alexandria. And that was a time I even joined the Lutheran Social Service Board of Directors. So I had the opportunity to do many things at the same time. And a year after arriving Alexandria, I got promoted within a year to become the director of the center. Exactly now, it's been about 5 years since I joined the city.
Yeah, between the current career you have, the board of directors, the PhD, it doesn't seem like you're busy. Okay, so actually, can you tell us a little bit about the work what is the mission of the City of Alexandria's Workforce Development Center? What is the mission? What is the goal? And what do you and your team do on a day-to-day basis?
So the work we do at Alexandria, so essentially the Alexandria Workforce Development Center is essentially, we have two core consumers of our services. On the one hand, we have businesses that are entering or expanding in the city, and we provide them with information and anything else that would help on the side of their talent needs. Some organizations, as they enter and expand in the city, we consult them on recruitment. We consult them on sometimes how to write job descriptions or how to identify the right talent for the right job, and also with job posting, a number of ways related to talent. So. And also, we organize recruitment events at no cost to them. So we do all kinds of, and sometimes we also provide incumbent training program, which means training up their workforce with some sort of arrangement in order to expand and strengthen the talent that the city offers to current and aspiring and prospective businesses. So that's the business side of it. But we also help residents who are looking for a job, who are looking for opportunities to upscale and improve their career prospects. We help them. So in a way, we are talent focused. We have solutions to businesses and job seekers, and we do this through collaborative efforts. We had a wonderful collaboration with you and with your organization. Like that, we also work with the business community, including the Chamber of Commerce, the Economic Development Authorities, and several business associations, training institutions, the K-12 system, the adult ed system, state, local, various groups. So we are a one-stop center where all these organizations come together to provide coordinated, seamless, unduplicated, integrated service to the community, job seekers and business together.
Now, I know that you work with a lot of special immigrant visa holders, SIVs in particular. Do you have sort of a personal desire to help them especially? Because I know that a lot of folks who are in that position, either refugees, asylees, will come to your office. Can you talk a little bit about sort of like the particular sense of care you have for them and some of the specific challenges they face?
Yeah, absolutely. We support, everyone who has, needs, who has interests in the areas that I mentioned earlier. And Alexandria is a very dynamic, interesting, lovely community, a city of 160,000 plus people. And one out of four residents in Alexandria is foreign born. And we have different populations. Some people generally may have generic needs. Ultimately, it's about economic well-being. We want to make sure Alexandria is a healthy, thriving community. So in a sense, everybody has a similar need. But in another sense, different populations have different unique needs. So For example, we support individuals with disabilities or youth or older adults. And like these groups, one group that we support in the city, in our work at the city is the foreign-born population, in particular refugees and, as you mentioned, immigrant visa holders. Because, for example, recently we have had one of the largest immigrant visa holders, special immigrant visa holders in the country. On a personal level, I know the journey of a refugee. I know the journey of an immigrant professional who used to do the kind of work that these folks were doing and their struggle to find their way in the US. So all those things mean something to me on a personal level, but our staff also customize our service based on the needs of this population. So we've done quite a lot of work to meet the needs, the unique needs of this population. And I'm very proud of the work that we've done, leading and coordinating efforts in the whole Northern Virginia region, including our friends in Fairfax, Arlington, Prince William County, and the larger region. So overall, we've done quite an impressive work. I am proud of what we've achieved in the past year in Alexandria in meeting the unique needs of this population, not only in direct service, but also in improving awareness of the unique needs of this population and also coordinating services, not only in Alexandria, but also in with our friends in Fairfax, Prince William County, Arlington, and the larger Northern Virginia region, where we had a number of opportunities to bring together hundreds of foreign-born professionals at Northern Virginia Community College for a day-long conference, bringing together industry associations and business leaders and many others to come and educate themselves and also educate these folks so that they can make informed choices about their prospects. Because there's a huge brain drain in this country where, you know, folks with a lot of potentials here, but either because of ill advice or because of no advice, they sometimes get their skills get underutilized and these folks become underemployed. And we've done quite a lot of work to change that over the past 5 years.
Can you talk just for a little bit about any impact that the COVID-19 pandemic has had on your work and on your office?
Of course. I mean, we're not an island. I think whatever has been felt throughout the country as a result of this pandemic was felt with us. But proudly, I would say our office has been open throughout the pandemic. There wasn't a single day that we closed as a result of the pandemic, but we pivoted to, in response to this pandemic. For example, all our work readiness workshops that used to be facilitated in person, we quickly, brought them to the virtual space. So it was quite a heavy lift, but in a short period of time, we brought them to the virtual venue. So we've done one-on-one and group-based workshops in online. But also so many individuals were hurting as a result of this and accessing relief. By relief, I mean, folks who've lost their jobs, had to pay their bills, and accessing the unemployment insurance benefit was a very tough process, for many. So we tried to collaborate with the Virginia Employment Commission to make it a little bit easier for many people. I cannot say that it became easier, but we tried our best in taking over some of the work from VC in collaboration. They've been very generous and collaborative with us to make that easy. For example, our office assumed the task of helping people with resetting their password, resetting their PINs, and also, producing materials in different languages, in English, Spanish, Amharic, and, Dari, in many languages, so that people can understand how to complete the application over the phone, online, and also who is eligible for what there was a lot of changes and not many people understand what those changes are. So trying to make it easier and explaining, we changed our phone system to one that would make it possible for people to get assistance in different languages. So we've done quite a lot of work. And of course, we also collaborated in helping people with access assistance to pay rent and mortgages and also grocery gift cards. So quite a lot of work to meet people's immediate economic needs by way of relief, and also, you know, efforts on educating them on how to protect themselves from the virus, but then later on, more effective employment opportunities. For the first time in the summer, we started virtual job fairs. We've done quite a number of job fairs, and we brought, you know, so many, close to 100 employers to come and participate in various job fairs where hundreds, if not thousands of people found jobs even in the middle of the campaign. And one of the most recent initiatives was once we've gotten the CARES Act funding, we creatively came up with an idea of helping people to those who are underemployed or who are become out of job as a result of the pandemic. We created a partnership between us and some employers where our funding supports the salaries of these individuals, but the employer would give them an opportunity to work and pick up skills. And it was just a small pilot where we had about 35 individuals to participate in such an endeavor. Nearly half of the individuals were actually secured employment with the host employer or with other employers outside of that as a result of that 3 months experience. This is a model experience. It was by far effective in terms of how much they became earning and also how many of them got a job as a result of that experience. So we are actually preparing now to scale that up and to do much more of that, because that is a way to address underemployment issues as well as unemployment issues.
That is really exciting work, especially given all the difficulties that, as you rightly said, so many people have experienced over the last year. Now, as we're coming to the end of our time, I've got to ask, I've mentioned a couple of times now that you're working on your PhD. I wonder if you might be able to tell listeners just a little bit about what it is you're working on.
Sure. So I am doing my PhD at the Virginia Tech Public and International Affairs as a School of Public and International Affairs, a wonderful school, a wonderful group of highly accomplished professors. So I am focusing on, again, on issues of refugees, and I am currently considering, I finished my coursework and I'm working on my dissertation focusing on refugee issues in particular, but in general, what drives countries in the global south in determining their willingness and ability to engage in international regimes, in this case, refugee and generally forced migration issues. So it's going to be interesting exercise. Just yesterday, I heard that the Kenyan government decided to close all their refugee camps in 14. They asked UNHCR to close refugee camps within 14 days. And this is something that Tanzania did so many years ago. So these are countries that host thousands of refugees, hundreds of thousands of refugees. So, you know, these are important dynamics, and I want to study the drivers of this kind of, you know, the positive moods as well as the negative moves. So, you know, the journey of the PhD programs, it's focused more on theoretical issues, but I am doing that during evenings.
Daniel, my friend, it has been wonderful speaking with you. Thanks so much for joining us.